Item 33. Other compromises, most of these, again, these compromises deal with interest areas of the country. The ones we dealt with earlier were large and small states. This compromise clearly over slavery deals with North and South states. And it's a three-fifths compromise. It'd be exciting to think that the three-fifths compromise may have dealt with an inkling of humanity about the evils of slavery. That's not what the compromise was over. What it dealt with was how to better their section in terms of taxes and representation. The North looked at Southern slaves and said, since these people do not have any rights at all as citizens, can't own property legally, can't vote, they should not be counted for representation in Congress. But since the people who own these slaves make profits without having to pay them any wages, that's a circumstance where they should have to pay taxes on these people. To which the South said the reverse. That since they must be cared for, asterisks around that, they must be represented in Congress. And since they don't pay any taxes, only the owners do, owners shouldn't be double taxed for counting them. So you can see what's happening here is both North and South are trying to do their best to use the numbers to their advantage against the other. Maybe this would make more sense if we explained this part. So often in school, I remember when I was going through high school, and even early college, we hear the three-fifths compromise was for every five slaves, three would be counted for representation. The reason that didn't really carry a lot of reason for a compromise is because most often the taxing part was forgotten. And the reason the taxing part of the compromise was forgotten because few people realized what it meant, myself included, until I did some digging and reading on it. And here's the reason behind that. When it was decided at the Constitutional Convention that the power to tax would be granted to both the national and federal levels as well as state, it wasn't quite clear what kind of national tax would be envisioned. Mostly, they figured the taxes would be based on assess taxes to the states based on population. So states would have to pay taxes to the national government based on how many people lived in their states. That was what was assumed going to be the major way of raising revenue for the national government. So therefore, as few as you could count for taxes was to your state's advantage, while in reverse, as many as you could count for representation in Congress gave you more political voice. That's where the fight was over. How to not count and count if you're the South and North in that regards. Of course, as it turns out, states never did pay taxes to the federal government on the basis of population. Throughout the 19th century, what was the major source of revenue for the national government? There were bonds sold, and in temporary conditions, that's true. But on running throughout the whole century, what regular tax was collected? Excise tax on products, very specifically tariffs. Tariffs on foreign goods was the major source of revenue. That would be if it was foreign tobacco being sold into the Caribbean. But if it was products being sold out, there was never any export tax. It's always import taxes from outside.
So it was on something that you were bringing in?
Yes. That was one of the things that the compromise we can talk about is that when products from outside were brought in, they could be taxed, but the things we have selling out would never be taxed. Export taxes would never exist. Now, right after that was coal tax, was the next form of revenue, which is the tax for money, which didn't bring in a lot of money. So you can see how the tariffs brought in most federal money.
Coal tax is what?
Coal tax, they have to pay a federal tax to vote.
Oh, okay.
Which originally was considered a revenue source, and of course, as we know, later coal tax is a weapon used for what purpose?
Cheap
white voters, but very specifically poor voters, and since African Americans were in the lower income levels of Southern society, that's why it worked. It was actually used against both. We get more publicity related to race, but it was a class way of preventing poor voters to vote. In the 20th century, the major source of federal revenue shifted from tariffs to what? Bet you pay some. What kind?
Social Security.
Well, income tax, yeah. Payroll taxes. So the original tax that was envisioned that dealt with this three-fifths compromise, which would have been states assessed for population, never came to be. In fact, in the Bill of Rights, there were actually 12 amendments put forth in the very beginning. Only 10 made it to 10 that became the first 10. Of the two that were rejected, one dealt with a formula on how to determine population and taxing on a changing basis. That one didn't pass. And the other one, which you could say it could have been like the 11th Amendment, finally did pass and did become an amendment. Anybody know which one that was? One of the original 12 first amendments. Well, it's our most recent one, the 27th Amendment. The 28th. What was that? 27th. 28th D.C. statehood. 27th Amendment says what? They can't raise their taxes their payroll. Stand for election. Yeah. And that came about, if you recall, this incident. That was ratified in 1992, shortly after a scene on C-SPAN where Bob Dole and Robert Byrd, leaders of two factions of the party, stood up together and said, sometimes we have to go across party lines and work on bipartisan issues to meet the needs of the country. Sometimes the tough struggles have to be met together, such as this one, raising our pay. And they did it with a straight face. Stood there in front of the Senate. And that was so disgusting to voters that's when this, one of the original 12 amendments that had been languishing for 200 and something years was revived, ratified in the few states that needed left to become law, made it. And even after it was ratified in May of 1992, members of Congress all said the time period is over, that amendment has expired, it has to be resubmitted to Congress. And some amendments were proposed with time limits on, but those original 12 were not. And so our National Archive has said, not the case whatsoever, it had no time limit, I'm writing it into the Constitution, let's see, go back and tell the voters it's not law. So it made it. So that's a bit of a deviation from where we are here. But the original three-fifths compromise was based on how many people would be counted for both taxation as well as representation purposes. And for every five slaves, three would be counted for both. And I stress slaves, not African-Americans, but slaves. Because in this formula, free blacks were considered to be citizens in the very beginning. They did not count in that fashion. Now, as time evolved, it's been kind of said, I'm not sure exactly sarcastic, accurately, in fact, that by 1857, the plight of the African-American had moved from three-fifths of a person legally to zero. What would explain that comment? By 1857, in the year 1857, the status of African-Americans moved from three-fifths of a person to zero. Anything about that year bring to mind a court case? Yes, the Dred Scott decision, where the Chief Justice ruled that African Americans, not slaves, he said black people, were never intended to be citizens at all, have no right to sue in court, slave or free, therefore Dred Scott cannot sue in court because of his race. So that then moved the legal status down. Of course, we know 3 years later, 4 years later, the Civil War starts and all changes. 34, next page. This is a kind of collection, a series of smaller compromises, or at least trade-offs, in order to pacify Western elements. It was agreed upon that new states could be admitted with full separate sovereignty, which was already existent under the Articles, so that's not that much of a change, and that all treaties must be ratified with a two-thirds vote, and that was clearly a concern of Western elements. Why would that be so? Both treaties with Indians as well as the attempted Jay Gardoqui Treaty. Yeah, treaties with Indians is clearly one that they're giving away things that would endanger Western elements. But if you recall the Jay Gardoqui Treaty from last time? It's the one where had the Eastern Seaboard elements gotten their way, they would have, I don't think you even explained that correctly. I think I only explained half of that maybe. That's why it's not coming back. That for 25 years, the United States would experience a trade-free arrangement with Spain, no tariffs whatsoever, but we would also give up any use of the port.
Right.
It didn't pass because it took three-fourths measure to get it passed, and they couldn't muster the three-fourths vote. So that's kind of gave an idea to Westerners that if there is more population on the Eastern Seaboard, simple majorities could easily pass treaties that are not to their benefit, to their disadvantage. If a three-fourths vote is required, then that trusts that at least a greater section of north, south, east, west, city, rural elements all have a voice protecting interests. Yes.
Now, was the result of that
nothing came
that they now needed, well, that treaties must be now ratified by three-fourths?
Two-thirds.
Must be by two-thirds?
If I said three-fourths, okay. I was tripping at that
point. You were
point
just now saying three-fourths, and I
well,
didn't down to
pay three-fourths. No attention to the man behind the curtain. Now the truth is two-thirds is the correct answer. I did that earlier today.
Okay.
I was talking about the press being the watchdog of government,
and
I was saying something
two-thirds
totally different from the press. Yeah, so it is a two-thirds vote is what... Two-thirds was needed for all measures in the Articles of Congress. But as we know, most things in our Congress now, 51% gets it, but they retain the two-thirds ratification vote for treaties because of this east-west sensitivity. And it's said here in 34, while there would be import taxes or tariffs, there would never be export taxes authorized, like our selling products overseas. On the import taxes, there was also a asterisk that went with that. This is where a debate over the inhumanity of slavery did evolve, and that is northern representatives argued that if slavery is the necessary evil that must come to an end someday, why not take the step now to outlaw the slave trade and let it die a natural death sooner? Which southern elements kind of could see down the road was going to come but didn't want to deal with it right away, and so they argued and left it for a generation or 20 years is what they put it. For 20 years, the slave trade could not be regulated, banned, stopped, taxed, whatsoever. So what you really see in that debate is leave it to another generation to worry about the ethical issues. Get a government first. So great complaints are made that people who were at this Constitutional Convention were slaveholders who protected their slave interests, talked about protecting liberty a second time. What they really did was protect their financial slave interests a second time. While that's true for some, I think there were others who realized that a constitution is better than not. And with the 20-year limit, that meant that after 20 years it could be outlawed. And it came to be that the convention was 1787. Ratification was in 1788 and 89. By 1807, Britain did outlaw slavery throughout its empire, slave trade and slavery, and then was able to point fingers at the U.S. as making claims of being the cradle of liberty while the hypocrites were slavery. A year later, in 1808, the slave trade was banned by Congress, which may make you wonder, well, with the advent of the cotton gin, there is a growth in slavery, not a reduction. So if there was a growth in slavery, why were they willing to ratify stopping of the slave trade? It was procreation in America was so prolific that made it. And plus also, the difference in what types of slaves that were born here and have never known freedom were far more controllable than people who were brought from overseas. So it always worked to Southern advantage. But there's rarely a situation where things that change in the slave situation are because of humane efforts coming out of the southern areas.
So by slave trade, we're talking about
no more
importation.
Yes, no more importation. And there will still be certain stories and circumstances of where those things continue, those violations go on. The movie Amistad, I don't know if you've seen that or not, deals with one of the more publicized issues where that happened. 35. Congress should be authorized to regulate interstate trade and international trade, but not intrastate trade. So what does that mean? Yeah. Across state lines, across national boundaries, Congress can regulate within the state of Arkansas in theory. The Congress cannot regulate like wages and prices and product qualities, and et cetera. But that's something that's left to the state government. Although we know that since the New Deal 1930s and the 1960s Great Society programs, Congress has, in many occasions, used the Commerce Clause to regulate behaviors within state boundaries, like minimum wage circumstances or working conditions, And in some cases, things that aren't even related to commerce, they would use the interstate commerce power to do so, which is what the Supreme Court has done some overturning and throwing out, and that was one of the line of questionings that Roberts underwent was, where did he feel about the courts restricting commerce clause used to regulate? Quite well. He did all of them. And one of the cases that I found most interesting was San Antonio versus, I think I've got this name right, San Antonio School District versus Garcia, where there was a case where somebody brought a gun to a public school in San Antonio, which violated an act of Congress saying that guns in public schools were outlawed by Congress. And he argued that, his lawyer argued that Congress did not have the authority to regulate what goes on in a private public school in the state of Texas on the grounds of interstate commerce. That had nothing to do with interstate commerce. And the congressional defense of that was, guns at schools make not a very conducive learning environment, and that ultimately slows down business across states. And the Supreme Court said that just doesn't wash and threw it out and overturned the conviction on that, saying it's up to San, it's up to Texas to make the gun laws, not Congress on that way. So a lot of the court cases we'll look at in the next chapter will deal with this issue of where Congress does step in and assert its interstate authority to regulate trade in defiance of what states don't want to put up with. Item 36. Now another compromise, which is not so much, it's not a geographic or a socioeconomic compromise, it is very much more an ideological compromise between those people who just traditionally disliked large government, those who feared the growth of big government being the end of liberty regardless of how well-intentioned, and those who saw the need for a larger national government for efficiency. And that is this concept we flirted with earlier, federalism. So prior to the creation of our government, there was an example to follow is unitary and confederate. Unitary being one central authority that issues law for all. Confederate being separate sovereign states that have the authority to make rule locally, who confederate together for trade or defense purposes, but are never truly under any central compulsive power. Federalism will become the compromise between those two, as it says here. There are state and national levels. There are very specific powers that are granted to both directions. In fact, they have to use fancy verbal adjectives to define them. Delicate, the other adjectives, not ever. And the state powers are deemed reserved powers. National or federal powers are defined as delegated, or sometimes you'll see it called enumerated powers. And those powers like licensing and taxing, which both levels of government share, would be called concurrent powers. So there are some distinctive different realms in which this is the authority of the federal government only, this is the realm of state governments only, which is really most lawmaking is still state level rather than federal. And then there are some shared powers. When there is a conflict between the two, there is a statement in the sixth article of the Constitution which says that the U.S. Constitution shall be deemed the supreme law of the land, and that all laws are pursuant there are subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And what the courts have ruled from early on is that means the federal level of government has supremacy over the states. Now, despite what the Founding Fathers intended that, the courts ruled that way from Marshall cases onward, it still wasn't believed by certain elements all the way until after the Civil War was over. That was kind of one of the great fights of the Civil War is, should be stated this way, are states subject to federal supremacy? And losing that war proved yes. Here are the Articles of the Constitution, 1 through 7. First one sets up, defines, and empowers the legislative branch, our House and Senate. Second article does the same for the executive branch, the presidency. And the third does for the judicial branch. And it's not out of order the way they're set up. That kind of sets up and envisions what they thought was vitally important. The Congress being first, the Congress should be the most powerful from the weak theory. Did we talk about that? Did I mention the concept weight theory? Okay, where you give more power to the legislature because it's safer. So that's why it was the first longest article with greatest limitations and empowerments. And then second, the executive or presidential branch was considered necessary next. And then the judicial branch is, to some degree, somewhat an over final afterthought, I should say. There was some debate to say that there doesn't need to be a national judicial branch, that states could do something. That obviously was not going to hold water if there's a conflict and somebody must decide. So then they moved the other direction and said, do we even need state courts anymore? And of course, yes, if you're going to have two sets of law that have to be defined, they have to be defined by two different courts. So there was decided to be a created third branch, our judicial branch. A created Supreme Court was in the original plan. And then what beyond that was left to Congress to define. So it was left to Congress to decide what other levels, which we now have district and circuit, how many, where their jurisdiction will be, what their powers can be. And the way it's defined is Congress can change that constantly. They can add more courts. They can increase the power of the courts. They can decrease the power of the courts. And that's been a debate lately, if you were watching confirmation fights, about if Congress tries to strip the courts of their powers, mad at the court for certain cases, judicial activism, making law from the bench. If Congress passed laws that say courts' jurisdictions are hereby restricted to the following activities, would that be legal? Well, it would be. I mean, that's the way the Constitution was set up, so that Congress, the safer branch to give power to, could limit court authority. So these complaints that this would gut the three-branch balance and deny the original intent, no, it's in keeping with the original intent of the founding fathers. And the courts would probably find ways to protect themselves, hand down certain rulings in certain ways that are pretty exaggerative is the word for it, I could say, but they've done that before. Judicial review, the concept we're going to talk about is exactly that. So the fourth article defines what powers are reserved powers, what powers will go to the states, and what limitations on the states, and what they owe each other or should recognize, such as the public records, court records, etc., from one state to the next. The idea that everyone who moves from one state has the right to citizenship rights in another state, which we talked about earlier in the articles, as part of Article 4. So, for example, say we were trying to burn up extra time, we could get into a big debate about interracial marriage or gay marriage, etc., but we're not. So we'll move on. Article 5 is the amendment process. In fact, I think I'm stealing from my stuff down here. Yeah. So let me just address it as it comes. Article 6, which I think is... Yeah. Article 6 was a miscellaneous article that tried to catch all the things left over that were forgotten. Two things that are in that article I think of significance. One's not listed. That one that is not listed is the ban on religious tests. A ban on religious tests. That goes back to that Act of Toleration of 1689, after the Glorious Revolution. Remember what it was about? That did not have to be a member of any given faith, especially the established church faith, to hold office. So the sixth article declares from open on, you do not have to be the member of or show any proof of a religious following to hold office. And that was the only reference to religion in the Constitution until the First Amendment later came along and added more. The other part of the Article 6, which is listed here, is this supremacy clause, which we already alluded to earlier, that the federal level are by definition superior to the states. And then the Article 7 defined the ratification process, that when 9 states ratified, it would be deemed law of the land. Even if there were 13, 9 would make it considered succeeded. They weren't really satisfied that they wanted all 13, but at least with 9 they could be considered legal. So once they got 9, Article 7 finished its purpose. It's just a piece of historic legacy now.
The other four were out of luck and considered bound to it?
We're going to come down and talk about that in 45 through 47.
Sorry, I wasn't ready.
No, that's all right. And it's good that you don't, or it steals all the punchlines. So. So if I did this correctly, and sometimes this works, about 50% of the time this little trick works. If I did this correctly, I hope I get the wrong answer out of you on this next question. If the federal level is superior to the states by the sixth article, supremacy clause, we have to kind of ask this question. Under the Articles of Confederation, states were the sovereigns, right? Now under the Constitution, where does sovereignty rest? Where is the true source of power under the Constitution considered to originate? Well, it wasn't the answer I was looking for, but it's still a wrong one, and that's good. It means I did it right, because with stressing the Whig theory of government, I led you in the direction of where would the most power seem to be.
Wrong,
but not the right. And you're probably right, in terms of historically exactly what really happened. But in theory, yes, that's the theory, is that we the people are now the sovereigns, is the first three words of the preamble state. So the argument would be is, we the people were always the sovereigns. We let those states have some authority during the Articles period. We saw that wasn't efficient enough, so now we're going to change our arrangement, and we're going, and what would have probably helped us if I'd said this, that in the Constitution it says, powers are reserved to the states and delegated to the federal government. That's the clue, at least Madison thought that was the clue, that they can't be giving themselves power. There's got to be some nebulous third force out there reserving to and delegating to, and if it's not divine right, then it just might be the people, which the preamble starts off to say. So that was federalists, people who believe in a strong central government, people who believe the need to shift authority from states up to national level, really stress that don't get freaked out and feel tyrannized by a national government. It's not going to be national tyranny. They're still servants, the states are servants of national government. We the people have always been the sovereigns. We give and we can take away authority from these branches of government. Those who disagreed with that the most would come in the 1830s and 40s in southern states, when they would argue that federal tyranny was being exercised and the states never truly gave up sovereignty, and states can defy federal law, and finally states decide to secede and form separate countries. So the argument of where does sovereignty rest continues to be a fight. And it's we the people when it's convenient, it's we the states when it's convenient for some. So that's what 37 is supposed to be about. 38, the national government would be divided into three branches, a legislative, executive, and judicial. Each would be granted certain specific powers, not only to carry out their functions, and let's think about that for a second. This may sound like simple ninth grade civics, but what's the function of the legislature? And the executive branch?
To execute.
To carry out or execute laws, and judicial branch to?
Interpret.
Yeah, to interpret the laws. But in addition to those functions, they're given the power to make sure the others can't do their job. Check and balance. Okay. Now why would a government be purposely built inefficiently? It's they wanted to add a little more efficiency, but not let the trains run on time too much over the passengers. That kind of rephrase a Mussolini phrase. Yeah. That was exactly their purpose. And that's what Cominger earlier was commenting on, what a beautiful accomplishment. That we should not be focusing, like Beard said, on who is trying to get rich at whose expense, but rather we should be marveling at the success of splitting national and state in three branches of check and balance with a system that worked. There are times, and this is more fun than on a test, but there are times when you can actually see each of the three branches carrying out the duties of the other branches.
Legislating from the
branches of court, or a Congress holding oversight committees on executive officials, which in essence is functioning like judges in courts, or presidents issuing executive agreements or executive orders, acting like a Congress. And so some say that those powers evolved not so much to try to tyrannize the others, but as a check and balance over the others. I think in those situations, examples like that, whoever is the more united, assertive authority gets away with what they can. Which is usually, if you think about it, despite all the built-in checks and balances, I think that since the 1930s, since FDR, it's been the executive branch that can get the most power and run with it. And even though it's the kind of power that people a century earlier would be frightened and say, that's a king, that's tyranny, that's, you know, executive totalitarianism, if those people keep getting reelected, it must be okay with the big check and balance, the voters.
So you think you gain personal power for the Clinton
then? Gingrich was?
Yeah.
Well, from my perspective, sitting in Edinburgh, Scotland, in December of 1998 on a vacation, when I heard that Clinton was not impeached, but Gingrich's caucus affair did resign after winning re-election, no. That's how I would answer that. Clinton survived, Gingrich quit. After winning the election. Let's look at the powers of Congress. They include what were already listed under the Articles of Confederation, which I don't have my sheet with anymore, but you recall them. Negotiating foreign treaties, establishing coinage weights and measures, a post office. What else did they do? Not a whole lot. Those particular powers still existed with the National Congress. What was added were these three powers here: the power to tax, the power to regulate trade, and the power to coin money, which coin money is not listed there, but it was added. Also the power to declare war, which may in these current days seem to be presidential authority, but technically speaking, the power to declare war is officially in the Constitution only in the hands of Congress. Does it seem, however, that since Korea, we've had conflicts that were accelerated and then practically started by both Democratic and Republican presidents? In fact, let's talk about the history of declared wars. Of the conflicts that have existed, which ones have Congress officially declared?
Pearl Harbor.
Let's try to go back to the very beginning. What's the first war? 1812 is the first.
Spanish-American.
Mexican War of 1845, three. One and two, right? I think just five.
What about Civil War?
No, just Lincoln called up different militias from different states and continued to put them into battles, and it just erode and evolved. So 1812, 1845, 1846, 1898, Spanish-American, and World War I and two. But we've been in a lot more conflicts than those wars. Especially the Vietnam, Korea, Iraq War, Gulf War. What might, if we take away the last two recent ones, from 1950 to 75, let's do that.
Korea, Vietnam.
Yeah. What explains how we got into those without congressional declaration?
60 days, they could spare them, the president's executive order.
That'll be a culmination at the end. Hold on to the punchline. Don't give away the punchline. What would be the explanation for why Korea was not declared or why Vietnam was not declared?
Because they weren't wars, they were conflicts.
Well, yeah, that's true. And that was conveniently labeled that way. But why weren't they turned into full-blown wars and declared? Well, what if your Congress declares a war, what do you, the public, expect back? That it needs to be, but also in the long run, you're going to demand a victory, right? If it's defined as a limited action or police action, then that doesn't necessarily mean the public can expect a full victory. They can expect policing. But if it's a war, we expect victory. And what might have been the price of a victory in both Korea and Vietnam? Yes. A nuclear exchange with the Russians, which nobody could win? That's I think, my argument as to what happened here was that when we reached a point where wars could no longer be waged on full-scale basis because of the Cold War, then you had to deal with the realities of what does the public expect with what you can't actually deliver. And that then meant Congress did not want to put itself on the chopping block on re-election for those things, leaving in the vacuum executive authority to grow. So that's my argument as to why executive authority and war-making powers grew, was because it was kind of considered that's who can do it without having to face re-election problems. and both Democrats and Republicans did so, expanded powers. Then what you say is kind of the comeuppance of that, is that after being involved as long as we were in the Vietnam situation, things were rethought, and in many ways, Nixon got a lot of blame. And I'm all for blaming Nixon. I'm not into Nixon, but he got a lot of blame that wasn't all his fault. That a string of Democratic presidents had started and then he inherited, which could have been Kerry had this won this last election. I thought a lot about that. He could have walked in and had to finish off what someone else started, but it fell on Nixon. And so when we got out of Vietnam, Congress, in November of 73, a good number of months after the Treaty of January of 73 ended our involvement, Congress passed what measure that you mentioned? War Powers Act, the War Powers Resolution.
And they can violate that, though. That's how National Guard...
Not only can they,
have they?
Almost every president has either denied its legality or War Powers Act stated that if a president wants to put troops in imminent hostility, they must consult with Congress first. They will be able to do so for 60 days, and if they need a 30-day extension, they can go on for 90 days. So after 90 days, they must come back and to then get congressional approval to remain in the circumstance. Or, if there's an or to that, there's two other ors. Congress can declare war, or a third measure, and this is the one that's most significant, that takes itself out of the day limits, is if an act of Congress approves presidential involvement.
Isn't that how
he
got through it?
That's how our recent
going
war.
Over there.
Yeah, the recent war is because an act of Congress authorized it, and pretty much blank check authorized it, without days limits on it, nor without a congressional declaration.
But Bosnia was under
that was the one that was, if he'd stayed there longer than so many days, he could have been subject to congressional, that could have been an impeachment there. But one of the things we also know is that when you look at conflicts where presidents have abused the War Powers Act, and I think if I'm correct, every single president, maybe Bush hasn't, but every president up to Bush claimed that the War Powers Act was unconstitutional and does not apply to them. Father Bush said it, Clinton said it, Reagan said it, but I think the current president has not even discussed that and dealt with that issue. Well, he's had bipartisan support, so there wasn't a need to get into that kind of argument. So that's how it would appear to many, if Congress declares war, how does it seem that the presidential authority has been so extended? Two answers. One is the Cold War created the circumstance. Second, my theory is that executives find ways to grow in power no matter how many checks and balances you put on them because they're one person as opposed to 9 or 535. Another power of Congress is appropriations. Congress is obligated every 2 years to review appropriations for military spending. Why do you think they gave it a 2-year limit? Because the House of Representatives is reelected every 2 years, and therefore if the public is happy with or unhappy with the level of spending, they can express it in the voting booth. So again, that's we the people being able to exercise a certain check and balance over the military. Which is one of the complaints back in the Declaration of Independence about the British military being stationed here without people or legislatures having voice over it.
Why is the House overseeing the Senate?
Yes. Why?
Why?
Good question. I think I had this down here somewhere. But it is, the House is every 2 years, the Senate's every 6 years, one third of the Senate is up every 2 years, and the President's every 4 years. Why would they peg it so that each is at a different place in time?
So you don't have.
Yeah, you don't have it to where if you the people got upset with your government and said throw all the bums out and start over, you couldn't. Was that a negative explanation? There's supposed to be a good reason in that, and there is. And also the court's set up kind of that way, where if you sit people on the bench for life, it's not just a case of that they're not responsive to the people. It's guaranteed that you'll have staggered people coming and going at all kind of unexpected times from quitting or dying or something like that. So why did they set up so that each branch comes and goes at different times than the other like that?
It's set up at the same time you have all the
which we do anyway, almost.
It's only like 57% compared to like 90%.
It is to frustrate democratic will. It's again a Beard argument. Why such a government is less democratic and less in the hands of the common people. Well, it comes back to something Aristotle used to say. He feared and hated democracy. He admired republican government, but not democracy, because rule by the people could mean rule by the easily impassioned mobs. They could all, some event occur and suddenly overnight everybody's ready to do something that's not in their best interest, but passions outrun intelligence. And so the founding fathers argued there needed to be a way for a cooling off period so that if it's something that people really want, over a number of years, they can finally, through one party, take over every branch of government, which they're doing. So people must really want that. Of the Senate or House or
both?
I think 55 seats are Republican in the Senate, 45 are Democratic, and then the even far greater margin of the House is Republican.
Yeah, as far as the president, every 4 years, I know they can't serve more than eight. But
technically, they could serve 10 if they came in on the death of another president and filled up 2 years vice president.
Right, but as far as just if they have a set eight, say they miss the next four, can they come back?
If they only serve four, they can come back again and serve another four. But once they've got their eight or their 10, as we define, they're done. Like Clinton's done for good.
So
Elder Bush could come back. Ford could come back. If he could come back. And Clinton could not. Although Clinton and Hillary, Bill and Hillary, have on more than one occasion on talk shows commented how it might be in the people's best interest to repeal the 25th Amendment.
Yeah.
Limiting him to not be able to come back.
Yeah.
And in fact, while we're on this, not to deviate too much from our topic here, but while we're on that, I'm kind of for that. I was even for it when Reagan was president. That wasn't a very good remark on my part, but I mean, I'd be for it now if he was president.
Crazy.
I'd be for throwing out the limit and letting him run forever. I don't think there ought to be term limits on
why?
Because somehow it's like saying, oh, stop those voters before they exercise their rights again and choose what they want. If the majority of voters want George Bush for six more terms, they should have the right to have him.
But that's what my whole thing was. I knew that there were the term limits as far as you couldn't serve more than two terms.
Right.
But I didn't know that it was only those two terms.
It's forever.
State.
Yeah,
it's
not just,
ban.
It's a lifetime ban.
I thought they could miss a term and then come back.
Doesn't exist on the Congress, doesn't exist on the court, but it exists only on the presidency. And why is that limit that didn't used to be there? There?
FDR 16.
Yeah, because Franklin Roosevelt won in 32, and when he died, Truman still as president won again in 48, and so it was like 20 years or more before Republicans had a chance to get a hold of it. It wasn't just Republicans, though. It was a combination of Southern Democrats who didn't like Northern liberal Democrats who sided with Republicans and passed that 22nd Amendment when they
returned. The reason they passed it is because during wartime,
they said it helped. Well, they could say that, but it'd be a little bit untrue since it was proposed in 47 when there was no war, and ratified during the Korean War in 52, but proposed as early as 47. So how did they clairvoyantly know they were going to be in war with Korea 3 years later?
Well, if they're in there for more than like 2 terms, is there any way that they have any kind of power to want to vote for the Democrats in a way on the House or anything like that?
You mean after they're out of office?
No, while they're still in office. And they get like turns to more Republican than the Democrat, or do they have to vote in a way?
I'm still a little bit lost.
Like, you said that there's 54 seats that were
in the Senate.
Do they have any power over that at all?
The president's? No.
So even with that, they couldn't eventually put all of the government towards one side, heavily in one way?
Not the president's. That's the beauty of the system. The Congress is in the hands of the voters, both houses. Used to be only the House, now both Senate and House is in the hands of the voters.
Yeah.
So presidents, they'll make appointments in that regard. It's an interesting system, but don't you feel like you've had your rights violated by not being able to continually elect the same person president?
It depends. They can do a really good job for 8 years, and then if you would elect them again.
Well, think of it this way. As long as they can run for re-election, they're beholden to us. If they know their last 4 years is lame duck, they don't have to worry about getting reelected. They pull all kinds of things. But if they want to keep that job, they better do what we want, their bosses, the voters. I think it'd be a better check and balance over president if we could.
It makes sense because the president's doing a good job. I mean, it's fine making leave.
Right. And if he's not, people have the chance to. Historically, Washington first announced he would not seek a third term and thought it was, you know, good behavior on president's parts because there was this fear that someone would get in and stay long enough to where their son could become an elected monarch like themselves. And the real fear came with the Adams. When John Adams got in, he wasn't reelected, but when John Quincy Adams came along, there was a fear that the Adams dynasty was going to rule and stay in there for a long time. Little did they realize it was going to be the Bush dynasty with Jeb being president. He'll be the first man giving advice from behind the curtain. She could never get elected.
You don't think so?
No. No, Kerry, a moderate, can't get elected. How is she going to get elected?
A lot of people say she's already ran the country for 8 years. Well, yeah, but
she's
the person
that's... That was Nancy, not Hillary. Well, anyway,
how long have you lived in Arkansas?
63. Oh. So, the next feature of Congress is the impeachment power. This is working. We're going to have another night. And we'll still be able to review and everything next time. It'll work. The impeachment power. The House of Representatives draws up impeachment articles, and the Senate holds the trial. Who presides over the trial? Chief Justice. What if the Chief Justice is being impeached? I would guess the next senior justice. Yes, I've not read that.
Can they impeach the Chief Justice?
Oh, yes, yes. Judges can be impeached, and in fact, during the Jefferson years, there was an effort made. They impeached a number of district court judges, and they tried to impeach a Supreme Court judge, Samuel Chase. And it wasn't based on a high crime or misdemeanor. They just politically were going after him as a target to get rid of him. And he survived it, and that ended the practice of trying to get rid of judges politically through impeachment. We're still working on that on presidents, but on judges it ended. In addition to these powers listed, as well as the coining, taxing, and regulating trade, a very significant power was granted to Congress, called the Elastic Clause, or the Necessary and Proper Clause, or the Implied Powers Clause. I think the phraseology was Congress is given the power to make all rules necessary and proper to carry out its delegated duties.
What number is this?
This is still in number 39, the end of 39. You don't see an elastic clause or implied powers clause given to the president of the courts, just to Congress. Why would that be?
It's we the people make what their opinions on, not a person.
And we trust Congress more with more power. Yes. Yeah, that's it. It's the weak theory again, the belief that somewhere you've got to have some flexibility on making laws for things that nobody would dream of in the future, or making policy, I should say. And it's a lot safer to give Congress that authority than the other branches because, as they suspected correctly, those other two branches will probably figure ways to get power anyway without being granted an elastic clause. And all this brings me back to a comment that was made on West Wing. I don't know if you're a West Wing fan. The new episode starting 7 p.m. Sunday. It was a comment where somebody was talking to Leo McGarry about how it once was that people were a lot, opposite parties were a lot more cooperative rather than such dire enemies. And one was saying that, I think it was saying, the Democrats are saying that the Republicans are our enemies in the House. To which Leo said, no, Republicans are our opposition. You should say it's the Senate that's your enemy. So that was the way it used to be perceived, which branch was against which branch. Item 40, executive branch, the presidency. we'll be moderate here on this. In the creation of the executive branch, I think the interesting compromise is the first thing to look at is how it was to be selected. This was debated back in the Virginia, New Jersey plans. And we know that the parliamentary model is, they're trying to build in 1789 something that's midway between a King of England and a Minister of Parliament. Those were the models they had to follow. They wanted an executive that was going to be powerful enough and respected enough to speak for the nation with foreign powers and conduct policy, but not become a tyrant. So they're trying to avoid too much of a kingly power, but they want something a little more independent than a Minister of Parliament, which is very beholden to the legislative branch in England. If Congress was allowed to choose the president, as the Virginia plan had proposed, that would not create a separate independent executive branch. So if you didn't have Congress choose it, what other possible choice might be? Well, that's what you come up with. But had you stopped, well, the judges could have done it too. If you stopped with your first part of the sentence, which I was hoping you would have said, the people, that'd have been pretty democratic, wouldn't it? What's the explanation for why the people were not chosen that doesn't insult the people? When they first created the presidential selection process and avoided popular vote without saying because people are stupid, why were the people not granted such a power? What they figured was people who lived up in northern states, western states, or western eastern, would barely know their own local elected officials. How difficult without news services and without people having easy transportation to ever know the politicians of other states. So wise selections based on experienced voting was pretty unlikely among popular vote. That gave the impression that as times changed, it might change too, but in the beginning there needed to be, as you pointed out, people selected who do know who are the better politicians. So therefore, not popular vote, not congressional selection, instead what was created? The Electoral College, right. And who would select the Electoral College? Who then, and who officially still by the Constitution is supposed to do it?
Congress.
You may have said it, but I haven't heard it yet. It's not people, it's not Congress, it's not President. State legislators. That's who was given the authority. So the creation of the Electoral College deemed that the middle party would be state legislators, same people who picked the senators. And it would be set up to where every state would be apportioned how many electors? Well, it is true. You get as many as you have congressional representatives, and you get two more for your senators. So how many does Arkansas have?
Six.
Four representatives and two senators. California has 54, maybe 56, something like that. New York has like 39, I think. And I've got to share this with you. I know this is not the way to end a class, but I've got to share this with you. This is horrible, but you'll, by the time we come back, forgive me. I had a class when you were, I was talking about, it was a summer class, talking about electoral college. And I was trying to explain how it is that when you look at electoral maps, you see all these red states and blue states, that people forget that a lot of the red states don't have the same number of people in it as do the blue states. And there was concern that why could a few coastal blue states sway the election of all these red states? Doesn't seem fair. And when I kept trying to stress the fact that because the blue states have all these people in it, not the red states. And then someone brought up, well, aren't those people mainly city people? Like that's a bad thing, like city people are bad. And I made the comment, and quite often in these city populations, a disproportionate number are non-white minority voters. So one could see that a certain amount of non-white minority voters can exercise a seeming greater sway over the Electoral College. And straight up, without even thinking, one person, white person, said, that's not fair for the real people. We'll be back next week, too. Oh, my gosh. Polls can start in either house as long as they get through the other house identically. Now, there's an exception to that, so I'll give it away, because that's going to be my punchline later. Yes, I'll do this. But, in theory, bills started in one house can start in either house and get through as long as you do an identical form. So it's not just that it's always the finish. It's like it's not the upper house in terms of bills always going up that way. What did we say about when we're talking about Beard's argument that it was conspiratorial, and I made the mathematical statement that was challenged about 5/6 of the government being out of the hands of the common voter? Which house was in the hands of the common white male property owning church member voter? House of Representatives. So how was the Senate selected? State legislature. So right away, the Senate is also a step away in terms of who selects senators. How about age requirements? You have to be 30. Where in the House, you have to be how old? 25. So those 5 years may not make much difference to us now, but back when the lifespan was shorter, it made a much bigger difference that the people who are still alive at age 30, selected by a state legislature, were more likely to be prestigious, prominent folk. How long did they serve? 6 years. 6 years is a lot better than 2 years. 2 years, you're always running for re-election. 6 years, you can have a couple of Monica situations, and by the time you're running for re-election, I don't remember. That was sarcastic. But it is true that you get more entrenched as a senator, build up visibility, build up money base, donations base, etc. So 6 year is a much more powerful stint. Is there anything that the Senate gets to do that the House does not? John Roberts.
Judges.
Yes, they confirm judicial appointments. Anything else? Well, the impeachment share. The House draws up impeachment articles and the Senate tries them. I guess being the trials may be more prestigious.
There's no clear winner
of the actually, it is. If there's no clear winner of the presidency, the House gets to do that, but if there's no clear winner of the vice presidency, the Senate gets to do that. Well, war is declared by both houses of Congress, but you're on the right track. Short of war, how do we sometimes negotiate things with other nations? Treaties, yes. So therefore, the ratification of treaties is something only the Senate does. And so far, for our could-be upcoming quiz on what makes the Senate better or more powerful, we have the requirements to get there, that's longer term, 6 years, the ability to confirm appointments to the judiciary, the ratification of treaties, these are all things the Senate does, the House does not. Anything else? Well, other appointments fall under it. Cabinet positions, ambassadorial appointments, that's all something the Senate does. So with the greater visibility, longer terms, being older to get there, these added functions that the Senate performs, the House does not, are we making a good case that the Senate seems to be an upper house? To some, maybe not as much as what the colonial situation are, but okay. So then the second question. Why would the large states agree to so much power be given to a body that favors small states? Besides, we just caved in to get a government. You're on. The money bills, yes. Taxing, coining, spending, that's the one exception to the thing I said before. They can only start in the House. While all other types of bills can start in either house and get through the other house in identical form, only the House has the authority to initiate money bills, spending, taxing, coining. And if power of the purse and money is power of government, that's a great counterbalance that the large states had a voice over. So putting this together, it would seem that we come from what, a small or large state? Small state, right, population-wise? So we would feel like, oh, the Senate protects our interests. And it might seem like New York and California or Texas, a large state population-wise, would feel like, oh, the House protects our interests. Do we, as Americans, feel that way? I don't think we do. What would that suggest? It worked. Yeah, it's a good compromise. Exactly. So, and that was the most important one. And we'll pick up more when we come back.